Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with IPR state government reporter Katarina Sestarek. She's at the Statehouse Law Library with a host of other journalists. This hour, we're going to get an update on what's been going on at the legislature. We have about, according to the end of the session date, May 3rd, we have less than a month to go before this session ends. We never know exactly when it will end, but that's the date that we're given at this point. Katarina Sestarek, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Ben.
Joining you in the State House Law Library, Kay Henderson, News Director of Radio Iowa. Hi, Kay.
Hi.
Caroline Cummings is with us as well, State House and Politics Reporter for the Sinclair Broadcast Group's Iowa stations. Caroline, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Stephen Gruber Miller. He's a legislative reporter for the Des Moines Register. You've heard on this program before. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for all of you for joining us. When I invite our listeners to join us, we'll be talking about, well, at least a dozen things, as far as I can tell this hour. But if you're listening and you have some legislation, a bill, something you've heard about in the news that's top of mind to you, important to you, want to ask the status or a question about it, join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Katarina, we passed a deadline last Friday called the second funnel. Tell us what that is.
It just means that bills that come out of the House of Representatives have to be approved by a Senate committee, and Senate bills have to be approved by House committees. There are a lot of exceptions to this. So anything that right now might be considered to be a dead bill could still come back to life at some point during this session, but it's kind of a way for bills to be weeded out and to focus more on things that might actually get past the session.
So a lot of what we'll be talking about this hour will be the did it make it or did it not make it through the funnel lens that we'll be looking at it. Let's talk about one of Kim Reynolds' top priorities that failed to make it through the second funnel, a constitutional amendment that would restore felon voting rights after a person completes their sentence. Katarina, start off by telling us about this and why it went down last week, right?
Right. So the House passed this 95-2 with the understanding of Republicans that they'd consider adding additional restrictions on felon voting rights next year. But then in the Senate, Republicans declined to consider it in a committee, so it didn't pass the funnel deadline. And a key Republican said that there just wasn't enough support among his fellow Republicans because they wanted these additional restrictions to be included at the same time that they're passing the amendment itself.
Mm. Okay, so it had to do, Caroline, jump in here. So in covering this, it had to do with the restrictions or the conditions under which ex-felons would be allowed to vote?
Yeah, it's been an interesting discussion because since the moment she mentioned it in her condition of the state address, Republicans were kind of uneasy in both chambers about it, though the Senate Republicans were much more forceful in saying, we want these conditions and these parameters this year. Parameters is this word used a lot by them to describe mm-hmm. what they want, whereas you know, House Republicans were willing to table that discussion for next year. So when it came down to it, I think what's interesting here is it's not that House Republicans don't want restrictions. It's that they wanted to pass the amendment out so-called clean, as they say, which just says, you know, rights are restored at the completion of a sentence and then work out some of those, what they'll say is policy issues separately in code. Whereas Senate Republicans are, you know, they want that to be on the table, and that's the only way they say they'll be able to advance it if they know what those details are.
Mm-hmm. This is not a simple bill. This is the start of a process that would have make a new amendment to the Iowa Constitution. That process, who can explain that process to it? Because it's a multi-year process, right, or a multi-session process.
Right. Essentially, the Iowa legislature has to pass the resolution in two consecutively elected General Assemblies. So that means they would have to pass it either this year or next, and then again in 2021 or 2022. And at that point, if it passed it, the legislature twice, it would go on the ballot for a statewide vote.
Mm-hmm. And so now, given what we think happened last week, Steve, in the earliest this could be put to us voters on a voting ballot would be 2022?
That's correct. And actually, it could, even without it passing this year, it could still be on track to be on the ballot in 2022 if it passes next year.
Mm-hmm. Has the governor reacted to this, the hurdle in the way here, that it has not progressed as much as she would have liked?
This is Kay. Yes, she has. She expressed disappointment, as you might expect, and said she was not giving up this fight. She'll be back next year asking legislators to pass this proposal. It appears the debate moving forward will be whether to change the language of the amendment to the Constitution and include conditions such as felons who've been convicted of murder, who have some sort of child sex abuse conviction, or who owe restitution and have not yet repaid the victim would be forever barred from voting. Mm-hmm. That's a debate moving forward. There had been some discussion earlier this year that there would be separate legislation laying out the conditions whereby you explain what completion of a sentence means. That will be the debate moving forward, whether to merge those two proposals into a constitutional amendment. Critics of that say it would make it more complicated for voters to see all of that language on the ballot.
I just would add that that's the interesting part of this, is it's kind of twofold when we're talking about terms. It's, do we carve out some convicted felons from automatic restoration, and also defining what a sentence means. Some Republicans say it needs to be full payment of restitution, where, as the governor has said, well, that would make it harder than it already is, because you don't need to fully paid off those debts to get your rights restored by her right now. So that should be an interesting way how to see how that shakes out.
This is Kay again. I don't think we can overstate how dramatic last Thursday was in regards to this issue. Mm-hmm. The day started with Marionette Miller Meeks, a new state senator, standing on the floor, tears, describing her brother, who was a convicted felon and never got his right to vote restored. And then you moved into the legislative arena in that committee room, where Republicans met in private for over an hour discussing this very issue and deciding whether they would come out and essentially rebuff their governor and push this off till next year.
And there was three members of the governor's staff in the room as well, including her chief of staff.
Mm-hmm. Was this, did you get the feeling this was unexpected to the governor, or did she see this coming?
I think it was a kind of thing that could have gone either way, and several senators said as much to me, where, you know, they said, this is, you know, we'll see how it goes. We have to talk about it, and we'll just kind of see how it comes down. So you get the sense that some of them weren't sure either.
Okay. If you just join us, I'm talking at this point about one of Governor Reynolds' top priorities, the failing to make it through last week's second funnel, a constitutional amendment that would restore felon voting rights after a person completes their sentence, and conditions, as we discussed. Stephen Gruber Miller with us with the Des Moines Register, Caroline Cummings of the Sinclair Broadcast Group, Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa, and our own Katerina Sestarek, state government reporter for Iowa Public Radio. Let's move on to Kay. Let me ask you about this. This is a bill that you've been covering on animal cruelty. To prevent animal cruelty, it has advanced. Tell us about it. What are the specifics of this bill?
For the first time ever, advocates of this bill have celebrated that the House passed it unanimously. It deals with companion animals, so dogs and cats, and it would, for the first time, establish a felony penalty for those who torture an animal in Iowa. Iowa is one of, if not the state, one of just a few states which don't have a felony for this type of abuse. It cleared a Senate committee, but my reporting tells me that farm groups are going to seek an amendment if this bill is debated on the floor to dramatically change it. Mm. Their concern is that animal welfare groups would use this law to target them and how they care for their livestock on their farms.
Mm-hmm. And so, Kay, are lawmakers fashioning this so that the fears of the farmers are allayed here? Can you?
Well, supporters of this bill say as currently written, they think it doesn't apply to livestock. Mm. But farm groups are skittish about this, right, and they want to make that clear, and they're drafting language to add to this bill. Mm-hmm. So the conundrum here is if senators do change this bill and send it back to the House, which approved a previous version unanimously, will this bill, in essence, die and not be acted upon in 2019?
How much does this have to do with the problem of puppy mills in the state?
That is an issue. And one of the senators who voted no in committee on this proposal defended puppy mills in, not defended dog breeders,
right, they wouldn't use
area.
The word
they
puppy
wouldn't use the word puppy mills, right. Excuse me, but he defended dog breeders in his area, and so there has been negotiation behind the scenes in regards to that. But one of the reasons that this bill did move forward in the House is that there have been some very high-profile cases of animal abuse in Iowa, mm-hmm, and a lot of people have a companion animal.
Right.
A lot of people in the legislature have a dog or a cat that they love, and so sentiment has been growing among legislators to take action in this arena.
And you mentioned Iowa has some of the most lax laws in terms of animal cruelty?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
I think it's Iowa and Mississippi are the only two states where right now you can't be charged with the primary offense. It's only a secondary offense if to get a felony charge for neglecting.
What does that mean,
primary
and secondary?
It would be that you couldn't be charged the first time you were caught with it.
We came into this, remember when we were talking about several years ago that you can't be pulled over by the trooper for talking on your cell phone, you had, yep, to commit some other primary offense like speeding, mm-hmm, and then you could be charged with speeding and talking on your cell phone at the same time. So a couple of years ago, legislators changed that law. So talking on your cell phone is now a primary offense. You can be charged for that alone.
Join our conversation. We're talking with journalists who regularly cover the Iowa State House about where bills are, if they've made it to a certain point in this process, the second funnel, they passed that last week, or if they did not. We're talking about various bills. Join our conversation if you have a question about legislation you've been hearing about in the news at the Iowa State House. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Well, this traffic cameras, let's talk about traffic cameras, because that has something that has been going on for years back and forth through different administrations here. I wonder, Stephen, if you can tackle that for us. Traffic cameras, what's been happening on that front?
Sure thing. Just like in the last couple of years, there are differing proposals in the House and the Senate. So the Senate did pass a bill that would outright ban the traffic cameras, but the House didn't take that bill up, so it died in the funnel. The House has its own bill that would regulate cameras and allow the state to take 60% of the revenue. And I believe that bill also died in the funnel, although it was hard to get a clear answer on that. And so I think it's possible that they might try to revive it in some way going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Appropriations Committee in the House, there wasn't enough votes to get the majority to move it out of the House Appropriations Committee, but there is a avenue that they can reconsider it, which could bring it back. Someone told me that, you know, there is an appetite to do something about it, as there is every year, and it's just a matter of, you know, seeing where that will, you know, how that will unfold.
I wonder what's at the heart of this traffic camera debate, because it's sort of shifted, hasn't it? Perhaps it's just my perception that when Cedar Rapids was kind of the center point for this the traffic camera debate, it was all about public safety, and maybe these traffic cameras were not creating a safe environment. And now we're talking about, well, it's really about splitting up revenue, that any town that has traffic cameras has to share revenue with the state. Who can enlighten us there?
I think the House was trying to take a different approach this year to kind of break that stalemate, because for several years we've had, you know, these proposals that go nowhere. And so I think that was the revenue portion of it was maybe one way to kind of change the focus of the bill, to try to see if there was more support for that kind of method.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The idea with that, too, is that, you know, the cities, not all cities in the state have the cameras. So the idea that if we, you know, can split the revenues, the state gets some, so, you know, other parts of the state can benefit from that money. That was kind of the went into the idea of let's do a 60-40 model in terms of splitting the revenue from those cameras.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Matt. Matt calling from Waukee. Hi, Matt. Matt, are you there? Okay, Matt, not there or there. Perhaps Matt is there. Matt, you are there now. Hi.
I'm here now. Okay, give me 1 second. Okay, I was actually driving along, pulling over. Okay.
Oh, yes. Be a safe driver. Thank you for pulling over.
I pulled completely over. Okay, so here we go. Last Wednesday, just a little background here. I live out in the Midwest Country States homes out there in Waukee. It's a mobile home park. We just got bought by a company that came in, and they pretty much they raised the lot rent 66% to 75%. It's happened in a couple other communities across the state. It's been in the paper, and it was on the news. We had a forum last Thursday. The Wednesday before, on the House floor, they did try to pass an amendment to give us some protections. It was House File 701. It was a manufactured home bill, and there was an amendment from Henson. It was House 1121 to 1081. Mm-hmm. And what it would have done was it would have just increased protections. If they want to increase the lot rent, they have to have a forum. They have to go to a city council county supervisors and such. So there were some protections in there, and it was thrown out as not germane.
Okay.
It's pretty obscure, I know. I just wanted to bring attention to that. And what is happening is what we need these protections for is they come in and they just make it, they're gentrifying. And it's rather than help giving us time to help people ease into the next affordable housing or whatnot, they're just trying to raise the rents all at once.
Okay, Matt.
So that's what this bill was about.
Matt in Waukee, thank you very much. Thank you for letting us know about your concern. I don't think anyone on our panel has anything to add to what you said. Let's move on to, another one of the governor's priorities, making birth control available without a prescription. Caroline, can you tell us where that is? What's happened with that?
So just a little bit about the bill. It would basically allow the Iowa Department of Public Health to issue a standing order, which basically would allow pharmacists to give a patient a prescription to self-administered contraceptives without going to a doctor first. So you could walk into a pharmacy and fill out a consultation form, discuss with the pharmacist, who may then decide to give you a prescription to, a hormone patch or birth control pills. So where we're at with that right now is the Senate moved it out of that chamber, and it is safe from the funnel because it cleared a House committee, though I think that House Republicans are trying to see where their caucus lands on that and if they have the votes to, bring it up on the floor.
Mm-hmm. How does this look when is it enjoy bipartisan support when it does get the support?
I do think that there's Republicans and Democrats who are supportive of it. I mean, Democrats will tell you in the Senate that they've brought up, this sort of legislation in the past, and two key leads on the bill in the Senate are two senators, who one is a pharmacist and the other was once at the helm of the Iowa Department of Public Health, Senator Miller Meeks. So there's definitely enjoys some bipartisan support.
Yeah, and this is Katarina. It passed 42-6 in the Senate, so there were only 6 Republicans who voted against it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's check in with sports betting. That's something we've been talking about on our Legislative Mondays and been hearing about in our news. Kay, a sports gambling bill which does what? Remind us.
It would legalize sports betting. It would allow the 19 state-licensed casinos in Iowa to take bets or wagers on collegiate and professional sporting events. They would be doing this over a smartphone app. The state would tax the take, if you will, on this a little less than 7%. Supporters emphasize that it's not going to raise a lot of money. Those who are advocates for the bill mainly argue that it will take something that is illegal and bring it out of the shadows and provide more regulation. It has currently cleared two committees in both the House and the Senate. It's eligible for debate in the House or the Senate. The problem is they're trying to round up the votes for it. There have been some adjustments to it that are rather interesting in that it would prohibit betting. They're called prop bets. So, for instance, if I were to place a bet that the quarterback would make at least 21 completions during the game, those sorts of bets, they're called in-game or prop bets, would not be allowed to be placed on Iowa college teams when those teams are playing within the state of Iowa. The supporters of this bill think that it might bring some people who have some skittishness about this proposal, bring them on board as a yes vote. Some folks who are listening to this may know that Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker was a Division I athlete. He was a wide receiver for Iowa State University, and he, this past weekend on Iowa Press, on Iowa Public Television, described how the compliance officers within the athletic department essentially scared the athletes by telling them if they did try to throw a game, they were going to jail. So he seems confident that sports betting in Iowa will not have a huge impact or any impact on college sports in Iowa.
Let's try to take one caller before our break in less than 2 minutes. Eric in Des Moines, welcome to the program. I have to ask you to be in a no-huddle offense here. Get right to your question. Yep. Thanks.
Okay. I'm a Soil and Water Conservation Commissioner for Dallas County, and I'm curious about there was a bill that passed out of the Senate, and it went to the House Agricultural Committee, and it's and I think it went through the committee, but it's about the ability to fund or buy purchased land and then donate it to conservation organizations like mine.
Okay.
Eric. And I just don't know what happened with it.
Okay, very good. Let's get a quick update. We have to go for a break in about a minute. Who can update us there in our panel?
So that bill has survived the funnel deadline, so to say. It's now eligible to be debated by the House. It did pass the Senate, as the caller mentioned. And, you know, Republicans who have been supporting it say that it will not affect things like water quality and flood mitigation, but Democrats are adamant that it will affect efforts like that.
Okay, we'll go away for a few minutes and come back to our discussion with journalists covering the State House, Katarina Sestarek of Iowa Public Radio, Kay Henderson, News Director of Radio Iowa, Caroline Cummings of Sinclair Broadcasting, also Stephen Gruber Miller of the Des Moines Register. I want to ask Stephen about an interesting article he wrote, I think together with Barbara Rodriguez, about why some Iowa legislation looks a lot like bills crafted by special interest groups. We'll ask Stephen about that when we come back, and we hope to entertain your questions about legislation you've been hearing about in the news at the Iowa State House. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Ben Kiefer with Katarina Sestarek, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News on this sunny, fair day across Iowa, looking at legislative issues with a panel, including IPR's Katarina Sestarek, our state government reporter here at Iowa Public Radio. Caroline Cummings is with Sinclair Broadcasting, Stephen Gruber Miller with the Des Moines Register, Kay Henderson with Radio Iowa. Enjoying your questions about legislation you've been hearing about in the news. Perhaps we can clarify where it's at. What is the state of that legislation? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Before the break, we were talking about, there was a caller, and we were talking about this bill on land purchases. Very controversial. Private organizations would be barred from using a state revolving loan fund with low interest rates to purchase land, perform water pollution control projects, and then sell it to local or state government under this Senate bill. I'm taking the wording there, Stephen, from writing that you have there with Barbara Rodriguez in the Des Moines Register. Let me have you, Stephen, comment on this, please, after I read a listener email regarding regarding this Senate file, which is a Senate file 548. The listener writes, much of these marginal lands are appropriate for recreation and conservation. Current laws already restrict and keep the acquisition price at a fair market value. This is a public health issue, writes the listener, and be reminded we are talking about 1 to 2% of our land in the state. Iowa needs more recreation space for all citizens instead of being hijacked by Farm Bureau. And the last line of this emailer, Iowa has the claim to fame of 48th worst water quality in the country and least funded for recreation. That claim is true, I think, Stephen, right?
I can't speak to that specific claim, but your emailer has pretty well laid out one side of the debate here over this bill. The other side would be essentially, you know, they mentioned the Farm Bureau in that email, and the Farm Bureau did support this bill. And their argument is that beginning farmers are being outbid for land by these private organizations that are taking advantage of these low interest rates on this loan fund that they say is meant for local governments like cities and counties to be using for water quality projects. So you have organizations like the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation that are buying land, doing these water quality projects, and then turning it over to the cities and the Farm Bureau and some Republicans say that land should be going to farmers. Like your emailer mentioned, some of the land is not good for farming. Some of it may be better suited for other uses. But I think overall, part of the frustration about this is that the bill, as it originally was envisioned, started out much more broad than the current version, which has been narrowed down significantly from what it would have done originally.
Okay, let's go to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Karen is on the air. We wanted to talk about the issue I think Karen wants to talk about. Tell us what you're interested in, Karen.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to know the follow-up, what's going on with the personhood, I think it's called, the birthing. When it declares a person, a fetus is a person, this is a conception. Mm-hmm. What is the update on it?
Okay, thank you, Karen in Ames. This goes by several names: personhood bill, fetal homicide, unborn person. Kay, can you catch us up on this bill?
The fetal homicide bill did not advance out of the House. It was amended in the Senate to include language that some groups found objectionable, and Katarina has done a lot of reporting on this issue as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the language, it started out as a non-controversial bill that would just raise the penalties for terminating a pregnancy without the consent of the mother. So if there was an assault and the woman had a miscarriage after that, then there would be a higher penalty for the person who committed the assault. So that was not controversial. The Senate amended it to change the language to killing an unborn person and then define that as starting at fertilization. So that raised concerns among opponents about things like birth control and abortion. People who support the bill say that it has nothing to do with abortion right now, at least. And so anyway, there were a lot of questions about the bill, and it was kind of at the last minute before this deadline. So a key Republican said even though he supported the bill, he couldn't advance it in the House this year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll keep our eyes on that, likely in next session, if at all.
Right, and I would actually add, that it seems like there are lawmakers who are adamant that they want this bill to happen, though, mm-hmm. and so I would maybe, while it might be dead from the funnel deadline, anything can come back. So
okay. The key lawmaker on the issue actually brought it up during the Senate Judiciary Committee last week when we were talking about animal cruelty. So to that end, anything can happen.
Medical marijuana has been something that we've been dealing with, our lawmakers have been dealing with in this state for several years now. When Iowa legalized medical marijuana a few years ago, it allowed no manufacturing and was limited to epilepsy patients. Now it's expanded to allow the manufacturing of oils, tablets, creams. I wonder if, Caroline, if you can catch us up on medical marijuana. Will our medical marijuana laws continue to evolve in the direction they have?
I think it's safe to say that lawmakers want to, in both chambers, want to take action on the issue. It's just a matter of some of the specifics, because the House moved a bill out of that chamber that would switch from a capping the THC at 3% to a 90 gram per, I mean, I'm sorry, 25 grams to 90 days. And so there was a lot of discussion about what the implications of that cap would mean, removing it and switching to this gram in a certain amount of time. In the Senate, they added that cap back in. So in effect, it would make it a little bit stricter in the amount you can get or the potency, but they are still seeing it as an expansion of the program because now under this proposal, nurse practitioners and physicians assistants would be authorized to say a patient is eligible to get a medical cannabis card. Mm-hmm. Katarina has done some extensive stuff on it too. I think she might want to jump in here.
Yeah, I would just say what was interesting about this is the Senate it has historically been the chamber that's been more open to more expansion of medical marijuana. Last year, they were frustrated that the House was not coming along with their ideas of what should be happening in terms of expanding the program. And so this year, the House passed this bill that would allow, it would allow much more potent medical marijuana products to be sold. But then when it got into the Senate's hands, they amended it at the last minute to make it stricter than the current law. So now it's really, I don't think it's very clear what's going to happen with that bill.
I wonder if any of you have seen, been present for testimony of people whose lives are and conditions are really affected, they believe, by the use of medical marijuana.
I would say that, you know, through the process, like of when they expanded the law and they were starting to open the dispensaries, there's been a lot of advocates who are there talking about how it has been a make or break, you know, medication for them. I would say that some of the dispensary people would argue that if they don't remove this percentage cap on THC, that it might affect people with certain conditions because they might not be able to get it in a vaporized form in the amount that would help them. Mm-hmm. And so there's now that's kind of the debate too about because the board approved vaporization recently to allow that to be part of the products that they sell. But they would argue that some people like people with Crohn's or ulcerative colitis who would benefit from, you know, a vape form might not be able to get it unless changes are made about the percentage on THC.
Ben, this is Kay. One of the interesting things that I heard during this debate as multiple bills on this subject have moved for the legislative session is an advocate, Joe Bolcom, a senator from Iowa City, citing some of the statistics about who has obtained these cards and gone to the dispensaries and obtained medical marijuana, something the average age, 57, the majority of them women. So that sort of in his argument puts to rest the idea that this would be a gateway drug for youth who want to use marijuana as recreation rather than as medicine.
If you've just joined us, Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa, Caroline Cummings, you heard before that of the Sinclair Broadcast Group, Stephen Gruben-Miller of the Des Moines Register, Katarina Sestorek of Iowa Public Radio, getting through a number of pieces of legislation, see if they are getting the thumbs up and thumbs or thumbs down in terms of the second legislative funnel, which was last Friday. Doesn't mean they're out completely, but it's an indicator of lesser chances of being made into law. Let's get to a couple of other things before we want to talk about some that have already been signed into law in just a moment. Before, we've heard in our news about a controversial election bill that would make changes to our election process here in Iowa. Stephen, I wonder if you can tackle that. What are the proposed changes and why are proponents saying they are needed? These are what, hour earlier closing of polls, signature verification, these sorts of things?
Right. So this bill started out, it was actually something that passed the House, I think unanimously, that would have dealt with absentee ballots and how they can be counted. That sort of stemmed from a contested House election earlier this year that was, there were some absentee ballots that were cast that were received after the polls closed that weren't able to be counted. And so there was a unanimous House fix for that. And then it went over to the Senate, and Senator Robbie Smith attached as an amendment to this bill several elements from a different bill he had filed, so they, including some of the things that you said, like the polls would close at 8 o'clock instead of 9 o'clock. There would be some signature verification components. College students who were graduating would need to fill out a form saying if they were going to remain in the state after graduation, and if they said they were not, they could be removed from the state's voter rolls. So sort of attaching these things that might be more controversial to this non-controversial House bill.
Mm-hmm. Caroline, can I turn to you to ask to name a bill that's been signed into law this session so far?
We have a campus free speech bill that was signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds, which would basically have the Board of Regents adopt some First Amendment spirited policies to allow freedom of expression on campus. But the big controversial part about that bill is that, you know, the Regents couldn't or schools couldn't, you know, If a student group wanted to say, hey, this member of this group cannot be run for office in our group because they don't comply with our group's religious beliefs or, you know, statement, that that's okay for us to deny them the right to run for office. So that's the controversial part of this. And Democrats contended on the floor that, you know, hey, if this wasn't in part of this bill, we would be in support of it. But I think what's interesting is that language in this bill has been found in other states. And Stephen can speak to some copycat legislation in other states that we've seen in Iowa.
Right. So this is interesting. I talked to the bill's sponsor, Senator Amy Sinclair, and so she was talking to me about how she got the language for this bill from I don't know if it's a nonprofit, but basically an out-of-state sort of national group that puts out versions of legislation. So it's one of many bills that Barbara Rodriguez and I looked at in a recent story in the Des Moines Register about how legislation from national and out-of-state groups gets turned into law in Iowa. And so this was one where there were several states, you know, conservatives have been talking about how free speech on college campuses is a big issue for them. They feel like certain speakers have been denied access to certain campuses. So one of the things that this bill does is makes it clear that college campuses are public forums, so you can't deny someone the ability to speak there. And it also has that provision that Caroline mentioned about student groups' leadership positions. Universities are no longer allowed to deny funding just because to groups that prevent members from running for leadership if they don't agree with the group's values.
Mm-hmm. And Democrats say that's just some of them would say that's state-sponsored discrimination by allowing that sort of situation to happen in a student group at the University of Iowa or Iowa State or UNI.
Stephen, I found your article written together with Barbara Rodriguez of the Des Moines Register very interesting, because we don't often ask where the wording comes from our bills, but you enlightened us with this article. Tell us in shorthand, where do a lot of our bills come from these days?
Right. So it's sort of a fascinating project. We did this based off the first, there was a 2-year long USA Today, Arizona Republic, and Center for Public Integrity investigation. And they developed a computer algorithm that searches legislation in all 50 states for strings of words that are identical. And so Barbara and I took that tool and looked at some bills in Iowa. And it's not an overwhelming, I mean, there are a lot of bills filed each year, and this is not a majority or even close to it, but you do find some bills, and in particular around sort of hot topics like this free speech or immigration-related bills and things like that, that the language pops up as being the same in other states. And so in our reporting, we talked to several legislators, and they said, you know, some of them said, like Senator Sinclair, that she had gotten she had used the model legislation as the basis for her bill, which was later amended and changed to make it fit for Iowa and become this free speech law. But there are other senators or legislators who say, well, we just looked at something this other state had done, and not knowing necessarily that the other state might have taken model legislation from, you know, it could be from a think tank, it could be from a corporation, it could be from some sort of interest group. And it's not always clear that those groups are behind the wording that can, you know, get introduced into our bills or even our laws.
Mm-hmm. Before we end the hour, let's talk about the budget. Kay Henderson, I wonder if you can talk about revenue, budget, all those kind of number crunchy things and how things are looking at this session and how lawmakers are talking about them.
Well, the budget process has advanced farther than it normally does. There don't appear to be that many hiccups. The one major budget item that I have found of interest is that there is a committee discussing moving the state historical building to the Iowa State Fairgrounds. They're unhappy that the fix-up bill for the building, which currently sits in what many in Des Moines call the East Village, ranges between $30 million and $50 million to just bring that building up to code and make some improvements. It's in disrepair. It would perhaps net the state some coin if they sold that property and moved the state historical building to another site. So that's been an interesting development as they discuss how to allot money for sprucing up buildings and providing regular maintenance support for the many, many buildings that the state of Iowa owns all across the state of Iowa.
Okay. And anything more specific, for instance, about the education budget that's being discussed?
The budget as presented to legislators by Governor Reynolds in January regarding spending for the Board of Regents institutions in Ames, Iowa City, and Cedar Falls has made it into the budget document that is making its way through the legislature in the same form. So it doesn't appear that there will be huge budget cuts to spending for Iowa, Iowa State, and UNI.
Finishing up here, Stephen, I'd like to ask you about another bill that's been signed into law. It goes by the rhyming name AG-GAG, a successor to a 2012 law. Tell us what's happened there this session.
Right. So, like you said, there was this law that was passed in 2012, and it was later challenged in court and struck down as unconstitutionally infringing on free speech. Essentially, what it did is it criminalized deceptively accessing an agriculture-producing facility, so like a hog confinement or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I had a camera, I said I wanted to work at this hog confinement place, but really my purpose was to get in a small camera and document something that was happening that I thought was not right.
Right, that you thought maybe was an abusive practice or something like that, yeah. And so that law, like I said, was struck down in the courts, and so they passed this year a new version of it that they say, that supporters say is more narrowly tailored. They took some language that they said had been found upheld by a court in Idaho that they think solves the First Amendment problem. I think supporters are still, or opponents of the law still say that there are some First Amendment concerns and that you're essentially criminalizing lying. If somebody lies on their job application and says that they really want to work there, that you can be, you know, found guilty of that. But there's stricter language in this bill that says you have to intend to cause some form of harm.
And is there any indication that the courts will not strike this one down?
Well, we haven't seen a court challenge yet, as far as I know, but it's certainly possible that there will be one. Like I said, the supporters of the law think that the language they have this time around has withstood court scrutiny in other states and might be upheld this time.
Okay, we have just over a minute left. I want to reach out. What do you see when you look forward? Please chip in here quickly with a few words of, what the approximately month or a little bit less than a month of legislature has perhaps in store. What will you be watching? Kay?
I'll be watching if the governor's priorities get through this legislative session and how Republicans in the House and Republicans in the Senate resolve some of the issues on which they do not agree.
Caroline?
I would echo Kay. I think because of the fate of felon voting, it'll be interesting to see where, you know, the birth control issue lands this year. But I'd also just say in the next, you know, coming weeks, they're hoping to wrap up in 3 weeks. So they say it'll be a lot of talk or discussion in floor debate about budget bills. That's a sure thing that we'll see in the next few weeks here.
Okay, Stephen, I think this will be the last word to you.
Sure thing. One thing that I've got my eye on is a bill that took up a lot of oxygen early in the session, and that's changes to the state's judicial nominating process. The Senate passed a version of that, and the House has yet to do a floor vote on it. It's been sitting over there for several weeks, eligible for debate, and this is sort of a big, you know, much talked about priority for Republican lawmakers that they have yet to vote on. So we'll see if they have the votes for that.
All right. Thank you for all coming into the State House Law Library. Stephen Gruber Miller, legislative reporter for the Des Moines Register. Caroline Cummings, State House and politics reporter for Sinclair Broadcast Group's Iowa stations. Kay Henderson, news director of Radio Iowa. And our own Katarina Sestarek, IPR state government reporter. Been a wonderful discussion. Thanks for all the input from our listeners. An engaged democracy. I like that. Tomorrow on the program, I don't have details on that, but I want to thank our producers, Emily Woodbury and Caitlin Harrop. Also help from Stephanie Nobrega. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.